We are in the book of Jude and working our way through it. And when I started it, I mentioned that we were going to take our time going through it. But hopefully now, as we do this, you're realizing we really can't take more than two or three verses at a time because there's a lot in here. It's packed full of things that just require conversation and discussion. And so we're in Jude again, page 1060 in the Bibles that we have provided back there on the table if you grab one of those on the way in. And we're going to be looking at verses 8 to 10 this morning. Jude, verses 8 to 10, and again, page 1060 there in the Bibles that we have provided. So just to bring you up to speed and be on the same page as we work through this, Jude has expressed and shown that he has some big concern for his friends, and it's concern that he would have for us as well, and we should listen carefully then to what he writes about, as it's God's word, and it's recorded for us to study, to learn from, and to apply. And his concern centers around the substance of the faith of Christians. That the body of belief that God established and gave to believers doesn't change. God gave it and it was sufficient for life and belief, and it has no need to be updated or adjusted. And yet there are certain people who are trying to modify the content of the faith that Jude is aware of. They're trying to suggest that what God gave and what the church came to know and believe was in some ways it was negotiable. There were some modifications, some updates that could be made. And in the previous three verses, before the ones we're going to look at this morning, we studied them last week, Jude explained that that adjustment of the faith, not taking God seriously, and when he said what he meant, that is not going to go unnoticed. It's not something that's taken lightly or disregarded by God. Those people are guilty of rebellion. And what they're doing, whether they claim to be Christians or not, is rebellion. And that's not something to be taken lightly. God doesn't take it lightly. And so we shouldn't get drawn into it. Because when you look at the body of our belief, God has a track record, and it is a fact that God always judges rebellion. He always does. Whether it's the rebellion of unbelief, or it's the rebellion in pride, or rebellion in immorality, those are the examples that Jude gave in the previous verses, but rebellion has always brought God's judgment, and it will bring God's judgment again, and so don't buy what they're selling. Don't buy it, because whatever it looks like, or whether it sounds like, they're actually selling rebellion, and rebellion always brings judgment. Don't buy it. And so we're going to continue to listen to Jude's warning and his concern, and we're going to study the next three verses, 8 to 10. And they're interesting, and this is going to be, for some of you, this might be a lot. And so I just want you to prepare yourself, get a drink. Well, we don't have coffee. Oh, this is going to be hard for some of you. we have to put our thinking caps on, get a glass of water, splash your face, and get ready to go, because these verses that we're about to read focus around an example that you might not have heard of before. This actually might be new for some of you. And so look at verse 8, and we're going to read through verse 10. In the very same way, on the strength of their dreams, these ungodly people pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and heap abuse on celestial beings. But even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not himself dare to condemn him for slander, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." Yet these people slander whatever they do not understand, and the very things they do understand by instinct, as irrational animals do, will destroy them. So maybe some unfamiliar stuff in there for you. Maybe some things that you just started question marks popping up in your mind. Like, what in the world does that mean? What is he talking about here? So we'll get into it. Jude transitions from the last verses to this next thought, by saying in the beginning of verse 8, in the very same way. So he's still talking about rebellion. He's still talking about rebellion against God's will. And he still wants us kind of in that mindset of recognizing God always judges rebellion. Rebellion is a bad idea. Why would you do that if you know God judges rebellion? He wants us shaking our heads, like bothered by the idea of rebellion. Like, I can't believe this is still a thing, because it always brings God's judgment, and that's something that we should know. We should know that. He wants us in that mindset still, because this is in the very same way. So, Speaking of rebellion, let's go back to these ungodly people I mentioned before, is what he's saying. Let's go back to them. And speaking of rebellion, I want to talk about these ungodly people. There are certain individuals whose issue is rebelling against God's will too, and that's not something we mess with, right? We just said that. God, the past will be present. God always judges. It's a fact that God judges rebellion. So that's not something that we mess with, right? We know how God feels about it. So let's talk about these certain people and their issue. And he goes on to explain that their rebellion, and he actually already mentioned it in verse 4, but he's going to give us more details now on it. Their rebellion is based on dreams. Look at verse 8 again. So in the very same way, so as rebellion against God is a problem that will be judged, in this same way, in rebellion, on the strength of their dreams, these ungodly people pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and heap abuse on celestial beings. So he mentions that this is based on dreams. This is another interesting word for Jude, only used one other time in the New Testament, this word dreams. There's a different word that the Bible uses for unconscious dreaming. It's a different word. It's not this one that it uses for when you're sleeping and you actually have a dream. This word, dreams, is only used twice in the New Testament, but it's better understood as having a revelation. You could translate it as a vision. In fact, some versions do. Use the word vision there or the word revelation. But because Jude makes it clear that these are ungodly people, it's important to notice these ungodly people on the strength of dreams. Because these are ungodly people, these are false revelations. Because these people are irreligious. These people are irreverent. They don't believe that God exists or that God does this kind of thing. And so these are not real revelations. They're false revelations. They're false dreams. But because these dreams aren't from God. And so in other words, when he says on the strength of their dreams, these ungodly people, he's talking about delusions. They're delusional. These are delusions in their own self-revelatory ideas. And they've replaced God and they've come up with their own reality or their own reason on the strength of their own reasoning, on the strength of their own delusions, on the strength of their own explanations that they've somehow decided this is the way that it actually is, on the strength of delusion, false revelation, false truth, they've come up with their own reality. And what we'll see is that the delusion is that they can be moral lawmakers and judges. This is the delusion. This is the false idea that they can be moral lawmakers and judges, that they themselves get to decide what morality is and whether or not what somebody else has decided or what God has decided is moral is right. They get to decide whether that's true. They get to judge it and determine the validity of that. They can create their own truth and find their own justification. It is their ungodly delusions. And what we see in verse 8 is that on the strength of this delusion, these ungodly people, it causes rebellion and sin. Or the delusion that we can be moral lawmakers and judges, what we're going to see here is that it causes rebellion, it causes sin. This idea that lawmaking, moral lawmaking, and moral judgment is our job, is our right. It's a delusion. And that delusion will cause people to rebel against God's will and fall into sin. And Jude will show us then that because of this, they rebel in immorality, and it's not a good thing. And so if you look at verse 8, on the strength of their dreams, their delusions, these ungodly people pollute their own bodies. Based on the strength of this delusion, this idea that they can be moral lawmakers and judges, and we're going to see where he gets that in a minute, but they pollute their own bodies. He actually addressed this in verse 4, where he said that they abuse God's grace in unrestrained sin. And here he's being more descriptive in that this is clearly physical. This is physical unrestrained sin. It's physical immorality. So he's giving us a little bit more description of what he meant in verse 4 when they abuse God's grace with unrestrained sin. And so on the basis of their delusion that they can be the moral lawmaker and judge, they have fallen into physical sin. He also says that their delusion causes them to rebel against God's authority, reject authority. You see that in verse 8. So based on their delusions, they pollute their own bodies. They rebel into immorality. They reject God's authority. And he actually mentions this two ways when we talk about them rejecting and rebelling against God's authority. Those next two statements there in verse 8, reject authority and heap abuse on celestial beings, those are grouped together. One of them probably makes sense to you. One of them maybe not so much, where you're like, I don't know what he means there, and we'll get to that. But the first one is obvious. Outright, he says, because of their delusion, that they're the moral lawmakers and judges, they reject authority. And this isn't like they don't respect the governor or something. He's not talking about politics here, that they just reject authority. They're anarchists. All authority is wrong. That's not what he's describing. This is specific to God's sovereign authority, mentions it in verse 4. This is specific to God's lordship. In fact, it's a form of the same word he used in verse 4, not the word master or word sovereign, but the word Lord. When he said that they deny Jesus Christ as Lord, and he's repeating it here, they reject his lordship. But he's actually emphasizing it further because he said that they deny here. First he said they deny, but here he uses a less common word, reject. Before they denied the lordship, now they just reject authority, which means annul. They declare it invalid. It's not a thing. It's not that I'm just avoiding God's lordship. It's that they're actually saying God's authority doesn't exist. He's not something or someone that even is there to respect or revere. They declare that authority invalid. And so their delusions, in verse 8, their self-revelation causes them to rebel in declaring the right that God has over them as Lord is invalid. He doesn't have a right to be Lord because he isn't Lord. They don't just deny, they actually say that God's authority isn't a thing, and they set God aside as a valid source of authority. So who is the source of authority? They're delusions. They are the moral lawmakers and judges because they set aside God's right as the authority, as the valid authority. But he actually explains this rejection of authority even further by saying, because they're grouped together, so they rebel in immorality because of the delusions, but they also reject authority and heap abuse on celestial beings because of their delusions. So this heap abuse on celestial beings, this is going to take a little bit of explaining, and that's mainly because we don't have the same assumptions that the world, of the Jewish mind did. So Jude is writing to people who grew up in the Jewish world, and those are his readers. And so we don't have the same, in America, thousands of years later, we don't have the same oral traditions. We don't have the same assumptions. We don't have the same context that the Jews did. And so it's important to know some of their assumptions because it will help us understand, especially when we get into verse 9, where Jude is going. Because if that sounds weird, it gets even weirder in a way when we get into verse 9. So I'm going to do my best to explain this, and I hope you can track with me. So a feature of the Mosaic Law, a feature of Jewish theology that was a point of emphasis for them was the fact that angels were the messengers through which God gave the law to the Israelite. The Jews believed, and it was a point of emphasis for them, that when God gave the Mosaic Law on Mount Sinai, he did it through angels. He gave the law through angels. And the author of Hebrews actually references this oral tradition. If you were to look at Hebrews chapter 2, verse 2, the author of Hebrews mentions this exact thing. He says that the law came through angels. He called the Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, all the rest. He says it was a message spoken through angels. It's in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 2. You can look at that at some point. When Stephen is giving his sermon to the Sanhedrin right before he is martyred and stoned, Stephen references the same thing, and he says it twice. He makes mention of it twice in his sermon before he's stoned. He says the law was given through angels. And so this is a part of their thinking, and they emphasize this, that the law was given to them through angelic beings, through messengers. And so in the giving of the law on Mount Sinai, what is clear, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 2, and Stephen in Acts, Acts chapter 6, when he's giving his sermon, he mentions this twice, and now we see here that Jude is talking about this in some way. What is true then is that when the law was given on Mount Sinai by God to Moses, angels were involved in some way. Whether they physically handed the tablets to Moses, I don't know, but angels were involved in some way in transferring the law to the Israelites on Mount Sinai. When we talk about that, we place a significantly greater emphasis that God gave the law to Moses, right? God gave the law to Moses because that's what's written, and that's the emphasis that we place, that God gave the law to Moses, though we never actually have maybe questioned how did he give the law to Moses. We just say we know that God gave the law to Moses, and God does get credit for things that he chooses to do through angels. That's their ministry, is to serve him, and God gives the credit for those things. And so there's not a conflict there, and Jewish oral tradition filled in that point of emphasis that the law came from God through angels to Moses. And so when we read, long story long, at the end of verse 8, when we read that the Jew, or when a Jew would read these celestial beings, heaping abuse on celestial beings, what they would read in that phrase is that as God's messengers, and specifically in regards to messengers of God's law, that's what they would read. So when he says that these people heap abuse on celestial beings, they're reading God's law. They're not reading, the Jews aren't seeing that as just the angels. They're seeing what the angels delivered, God's standard for his character and his thought and living in relationship with them. They heap abuse on the law, because they're heaping abuse on the messengers. And so he says, in the rebellion, they heap abuse. And that's an interesting way to translate the word that's there in the Greek. In other places, that word heap abuse, you'll see it translated slander. Most commonly, you'll see that word translated blaspheme. In fact, the word is used one time in each of these three verses. Verse 8, verse 9, and verse 10 each have the same word, blaspheme, or slander, or heap abuse. It's the same word used three different times. And so what Jude is saying is that because of their delusions, these people rebel by blaspheming angels, by slandering angels. And that's an odd expression for us, heap abuse on celestial beings, blaspheme angels, slander messengers, slander angels. But within their context, the readers would have known, oh, only people who deny God's authority and his law are accused of blaspheming angels. The only people accused of blaspheming angels, of slandering angels, are people who deny that God's law is a thing. Because if you discredit the messenger, you discredit the message. And angels to them delivered the message of God's law, his standard, his standard for character. And so when we blaspheme angels, when we slander the messenger, we're discrediting the entire message as well. They're rejecting God's moral authority when they do this. They undermine the legitimacy of God's standards for relationship with him by speaking out against the source or the mechanism that he gave the law by. And so they throw out the baby with the bathwater, is what they're doing. When they heap abuse on celestial beings, it's a Jewish way of saying they throw the whole law out the window. And their rebellion leads them to accuse the validity of God's law. And so even though adherence to the law doesn't save us, the law does explain God's standards and his heart and his character, and it carries significant authority. And what these people are doing in their delusional rebellion, Jude is saying, is that they are rejecting God's authority and rejecting anything he has spoken. The messengers, the message, the authority behind it, it's all hogwash. Throw it out the window. We don't buy any of it. We're rebelling against all of it. And they refuse to acknowledge the validity of God's laws and his standards. He's not the authority. They reject authority and they throw the baby out with the bathwater, is what he's saying in Jude 8. Because of the delusion that they can be lawmakers and judges. So this is some serious rebellion driven by this delusion. They're saying God's not a thing, God's moral standards aren't things, we don't have to do any of that. It's just nonsense. That's verse 8. So hopefully you're still with me in this. And it's going to all come together at the end. So Jude has been talking about their rebellion, the rebellion of these people, these ungodly people who, because of their rebellion, they just go wholesale into immorality because they completely reject God's authority and the law, the character, all of those things that he gave as standards, it's out the window. So now he's going to give us a contrast and one that will probably not sound familiar to you in verse 9. So let's look at it. So they reject authority, but Even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not himself dare to condemn him for slander, but instead said, "The Lord rebuke you." We're going to work through this. So he starts with "but," which you should read "on the other hand," or "but," right? So in the very same way, in the same rebellion, these ungodly people, because of their delusion that they can be lawmakers and judges, they rebel into physical immorality, and they rebel in rejecting God's authority and saying that his authority isn't a thing because he's not a thing. So all that fancy list of stuff that you say that pleases God, it's nonsense. We don't have to do that. But, verse 9, even the archangel Michael, right? This is like, on the other hand, this lets us know that this is a contrast, an example of someone who's not a victim of delusion. And because he's not a victim of this delusion, he demonstrates a better approach than the rebellion that these people are pursuing in their self-revelation. And so the example is about an angel named Michael, the archangel. We're introduced to Michael, if you're not familiar with him, we're introduced to Michael back in the book of Daniel, where he's described as one of the chief spiritual princes. He's a high-ranking angel, a chief spiritual prince. Here is the second and only other time that we see the word archangel. So we're introduced to Michael, where he's a spiritual prince back in Daniel, and now he's given the title archangel, and this is the second time we see the word. And that word actually means chief angel. Chief angel. The other time that we see the word archangel is in 1 Thessalonians, where we learn that the archangel, the chief angel, will join Jesus in commanding the physical salvation of believers before the end times begin. That's the only other time we see the word archangel, the chief angel. And so it's a fair and safe assumption that that angel then is Michael, helping Jesus command the salvation of believers. But here that archangel is identified. It's Michael. He's the only named archangel in the Bible. And Jude tells us that Michael, and this is maybe something that it begins to become unfamiliar with you, is that Michael disputed with the devil about the body of Moses. If this sounds unfamiliar to you, it's probably because you've never read this verse, because it's nowhere else mentioned in the Bible. What he just said is not mentioned in the Bible anywhere else. But this statement, this claim, was not unfamiliar to his Jewish readers. This account was an oral tradition passed down from generations among the Jews, and eventually this account, what he's describing here, Michael and the devil disputing over Moses' body, it is eventually recorded after Jude was written. So it's an oral tradition where the Jews just share this as a story, as a history, where they meet together and they share the histories that they have in the Old Testament and those stories. They share it, and eventually after Jude writes his letter, it is written down. The shared story is written down in a late first century document called the Assumption of Moses, Assumption of Moses. Here's the account we have in the Old Testament, in the Bible, regarding Moses' death. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 34, verses 5 to 6. This is what we have in the Old Testament about this situation. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, as the Lord had said, if you remember, because of Moses' own rebellion, and rebellion will always be judged. He was not allowed to go into the promised land because of his own mistakes. And so that was the deal. And so he's there on this mountain, and he dies there. And so he buried him, he speaking specifically of God, buried him in Moab in the valley opposite of Beth Peor. But to this day, no one knows where the grave is. That's what we have recorded for us in Deuteronomy. Joshua would have written that tells us the situation regarding Moses' death. Moses was buried by God. Right? That's what we have. But the elaboration that the Jews passed down, probably from Joshua on down, the elaboration that the Jews had in the oral tradition is much like God gave the law at Mount Sinai, but the mechanism was angels. Right? God gave the law. Moses got the law from God. In between, angels passed it on. Right? Much like that, the oral tradition is that Michael was sent by God to bury Moses. God buried Moses through the actions of Michael. This is the oral tradition that the Jews have. And in the process, the devil confronted Michael, and he challenges him. This is the old tradition. Eventually, it was written down in Assumption of Moses. But this confrontation between Michael and the devil is not actually unheard of in the Bible. Daniel records a similar confrontation when an angel explains that on his way to give Daniel a message from God, that angel found himself in a 21-day confrontation in which a fallen angel attempts to stop him from delivering his message. Okay, that's in the book of Daniel. And although that fallen angel was unsuccessful, obviously the message gets to Daniel in his vision. And so this confrontation behind the scenes is not unheard of. And so tradition explains that Satan confronts Michael over the burial of Moses' body, and he challenges God's determination that Moses should be buried with honor, buried by God. And so you may never have heard of this tradition. You may have never heard of its recorded form, the Assumption of Moses. It's clearly not in our Bible, in the Old Testament, this dispute, this burial situation. And this verse is the only piece that we have. And we're going to get more into this situation about how the Bible came to us and those in the coming weeks, how it's reliable and how we trust this version that we have. And so we're going to get to that here in a few weeks. But just because this is going to happen again when we get a few verses where Jude quotes from a book that you've probably not heard of. He's going to do it here in the next few verses. But just because this is unusual doesn't mean that it's not true. And the fact that Jude uses it here in verse 9, led by the Holy Spirit, inspired by God, suggests that at least this part of the oral tradition is true because the Holy Spirit confirms it as true through Jude. So this moment, this dispute, because the Holy Spirit leads Jude to write it, this actually happened. This part of the oral tradition is for sure true. That there was a dispute between Michael and the devil over the burial of Moses. So when God buried Moses, he did it through Michael, and the devil tried to stop him. And he disputed with Michael and what Michael was going to do. And so the word dispute, let's go back to the verse 9. When he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, that word disputing, it's an interesting word, just like Jude has been doing with us. He uses interesting words because that word is a legal word about an argument over technicalities. It's a legal word in the Greek world where they're arguing over technicalities. They're going through the fine details of something, and the devil is saying, I got you tripped up, right? There's a loophole here, and here it is. Legally, you can't do this, or whatever it is. There's an argument over technicalities here. That's what that word dispute means. And so we have to ask ourselves, when we read this, what technicalities, what would be the devil's claim that Michael's out of line, that he can't do this? What legalities would he be arguing about regarding the honor that Moses is getting being buried by God? Because it was very clear in the text that this is an honor. This is an honor that Moses was buried by God, as opposed to just left there or someone else giving him a tomb and a burial. So what legality would the devil be arguing here that would cause this dispute, this challenge? The devil could have a few claims, and we can just kind of guess, but the devil would have a few claims, and there's a few that most commentators agree are probably what the issue is. The first, the devil is the prince of the world, and he surely feels like he's in charge, that everything that happens here, he's got say in, he's got input in, and specifically death is his domain. Death and what happens there to humans, like that's his thing. That's his bread and butter. And he's the prince of the world. And so he's probably thinking, I have some rights here when it comes to death, because that's what I do. But even more, Moses was a murderer. You look at Exodus chapter 2, verse 12. Right, and you see that story. Moses was a murderer. Moses was not, like, in his earlier age, the shining example of morality. And so the claim could be, and a lot of commentators agree, that the claim is he doesn't deserve the honor of a divine burial. This guy was a murderer, and he messed up on more than one occasion. After all, he's not in the land. Did he really have faith in God? Did he really have faith in God if God's not letting him into the promised land like anybody else? And so you can see that the devil actually does have some arguments that he could be arguing on technicality. This guy doesn't have the faith that the rest of the people did. This guy was a murderer. He doesn't have the moral standards that everybody else did. He has a dark past. And I'm the one in charge of death. I'm the one that determines what's happening here. I have the right to make this decision. And so the devil argues legality with Michael. He debates. They are disputing legal things, technicalities over the burial of Moses. And he argues this with Michael, and he challenges God's determination. This is what he's doing. God determined that Moses should be buried divinely, with honors, through the hands of Michael. That's what God decided. But Jude wants us to see that Michael's response is not the same. Is because there's similarities in the situation, he wants us to see that it's not the same as these people. He wants us to see Michael's response to the challenge of God's determination, because this is where the contrast is. And so in response to the devil challenging God's authority, saying that, Michael, you need to go bury Moses, give him the honor of a divine burial. That's God's authority, his determination. What he said is going to be happening, right? In response, the devil challenged that authority. And so what does Michael do when presented with an option to not quite do what God said, right? And this is the situation that these people have been doing, right? We don't really have to do what God says. We don't actually have to obey God. It's not a thing. Obeying God isn't something that people have to do because that authority isn't valid. So, well, let's look at an example. Let's look at the example of Michael when he was challenged with the opportunity to not do what God said. What does Michael do? He wants us to see Michael's response. And Michael, verse 9, did not himself dare to condemn him for slander. That's an awkward phrase. And the best way to translate this is actually what the English Standard Version does. It says that Michael did not dare pronounce a blasphemous judgment. You see that word again. Blasphemous, slander, heap abuse. Michael didn't dare pronounce a blasphemous judgment. And the word condemn that you see in the NIV, he did not himself dare to condemn him for slander. That word condemn always means judge. Always. It always means judge. Make a determination. And so you see that word again, slander, blaspheme, accuse. And what Jude is saying in this, using this situation, is that Michael was there as a messenger of the law. Michael was there as a messenger of God to speak and act on God's behalf. He was a messenger of what God decided and said was going to happen, what God's will was. And in this case, the determination, the will of God, the law that God established was that Moses would be buried with honor. In this case, it's about the body of Moses. God said it should be buried. Done. That's what God said. And the devil was basically telling Michael, I know what God told you to do, but here's what I'm telling you to do. Here's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that he doesn't deserve to be buried with honor. I'm suggesting that that's not actually God's right to determine what happens with Moses, because I'm the prince of the world. I'm the one that deals in sin and death. And so I'm telling you, Michael, you don't have to do what God said. You don't have to obey here. In fact, you could, since you're the messenger, you could make a different decision. You could make a different determination, because God's not here with me and Moses. You are. So why don't we make a deal? Why don't we say something different? Why don't we change the message, right? Instead of pronouncing a blasphemous judgment, Michael, instead of saying, that's a good point, we got some good points here, Satan, you're right, he was a murderer, your technicalities are tripping me up, and instead of saying, maybe you should just do it your way then, God clearly either didn't know this or he wasn't aware of what these things are, that would be a blasphemous judgment. It would be making your own judgment and slandering what God had decided. Instead of doing that, instead of giving his own blasphemous judgment, and making his own criticism of what God said and going along with the challenge to God's right and authority. Michael didn't take the matter out of God's hands. He left it with God. He said, instead of making his own judgment, he said, you know what? The Lord rebuke you. This is not the only time that Satan hears this response. It's very interesting. This is not the only time that Satan hears this exact statement. The Lord rebuke you. Zechariah also recorded another occasion where Satan was trying to accuse a high priest of guilt, and God responds with this exact phrase, the Lord rebuke you, Satan. And there, with that statement, as here, he was being told, this isn't your place, get out of here. When he was told that in Zechariah, when he's told that here with Michael and this dispute over Moses' body, he's saying, this isn't your place. It's not your place to question God's determination. It's not your place to think that maybe on the basis of some good argument, you should be able to change what God said. It's not your place. The Lord rebuke you. You're stepping out of line, is what he's saying. And with that, Michael is saying, it's not your place, and this isn't my place. It's certainly not your place, but it's not my place. So bring this to God, and you'll be rebuked. You take this to God, and he'll tell you what it is, and the answer is going to be, get out of here. Stop questioning my authority. Stop trying to change and challenge what I've already said is going to happen. Moses is going to be buried. End. Done. And Michael is saying, this isn't for me to judge. This is between you and God. He's the judge, and he's determined Moses' final treatment. I'm not changing it. I'm not challenging it. I'm obeying it. So get out of my way. I'm going to bury him. And guess what happened in Deuteronomy? Moses was buried. And with this example, Jude is showing us that even the archangel, the chief of angels, a messenger of God's will who spoke and acted on behalf of God, wouldn't dare rewrite or reinterpret or set aside God's words or put words in God's mouth and say, you're right, this could be changed. Even the archangel wouldn't dare challenge God's authority. You would think that if anybody, the right-hand man of God besides Jesus, the archangel, the one who's going to help Jesus command the salvation, he would at least have some authority to go, that's a good point. That's a good point. You know what? Maybe you're right. Even he wouldn't dare rewrite what God has said. Instead, he said, it's not our place to make law or judge. It is God's place. Get out. I'm burying Moses because God said to. And Michael surrenders himself and the final ruling to God. This is what he said. This is what we do. So that's in contrast to those who, in their own delusion, think they can write their own law and be their own judges about morality. Even Michael, the archangel, said, yeah, we don't have that right. We don't have the right to rewrite law. Now look at verse 10. Yet these people slander whatever they do not understand. You see the word slander there again? Blaspheme, heap abuse. It's the third use of it. These people slander whatever they do not understand, and the very things they do understand by instinct, as irrational animals do, will destroy them. Yet, so that was Michael's response to the possibility of rebelling against God's authority. There was no delusion in his response. There was no self-justification. I am the archangel. I guess that's a good point. There was no delusion there. God's authority is God's authority. It doesn't matter what my position is. I don't rewrite it. I'm not the lawmaker. I'm not the judge. So he wouldn't judge God's will. He wouldn't rewrite his words. Yet these people in verse 10, they blaspheme, they abuse, they slander anything they don't know. And they claim that they don't know anything that God says. They don't consider any of it valid. Anything they're not acquainted with, meaning anything that doesn't feel right, anything they don't know, anything they don't experience, they slander it. That anything that doesn't match their experience, they challenge, they abuse, they discredit, they reject. Specifically in context, what they're rejecting is God's determinations and authorities because they don't know it. I don't feel it. It doesn't feel right. Anything they don't know, they abuse. They pronounce false judgment on the basis of their delusion that they're the lawmakers, they're the judge. And what God has said doesn't feel right. I don't experience it the way that he's saying it. I experience something different. And so they reject it. And what Jude is telling us that is that in their delusion, they elevate themselves to moral lawmakers and judges because their truth, or God's truth, doesn't fit their dreams. And so because God's truth doesn't fit their dreams, doesn't fit their sensibilities, doesn't fit their self-made ideals, they rebel against God's truth and say, I'm the lawmaker here. I'm the judge here. But unfortunately, what Jude is explaining to us is that it doesn't lead to the freedom they think it will. I don't want to do what God is saying to do. I don't want to live under the authority of God because that just seems like nonsense to me. It doesn't match my experiences or my feelings. I'm going to be the lawmaker. I'm going to be the judge. But Jude says that's not freeing. You think if you're free to then do whatever you want, make your own decisions. They think it's freeing, but it's not autonomy. It's not really in control. What really happens is that in doing this, he says in verse 10, in rebelling against the authority of God and elevating themselves to lawmakers and judges based on their own delusions, they instead become slaves. The delusion that we can be moral lawmakers and judges doesn't lead to freedom, it leads to slavery. These people abuse whatever they don't experience or feel, and the very things that they do understand by feeling, by instinct, will destroy them. The idea that you can determine what law, moral law is, and then you can judge right and wrong based on your own sensibilities and your own realities, your own delusions, is not freedom, it is slavery. We become slaves to instinct. Deluding yourself into believing that you can be that lawmaker and judge like God seems freeing, but it will only make you a slave to instinct like an irrational animal, Jude says. And that decision to go with what you know, go with what you feel, go with what you experience, whatever fits your delusion, it will destroy them, in verse 10. Will destroy them. Instinct in humans, because of sin, is not good. Instinct, feeling, experience in humanity, because sin is intertwined with that, is not good. It is harmful. In Proverbs chapter 29, verse 18, Solomon collects this proverb and leaves it there for us to learn from. But he says, when there is no revelation, people cast off restraint. Meaning, when we reject God's law and his lawmaker, as the lawmaker and as the judge, when we say, that's not a thing, I don't have to do that, I'm going to avoid that altogether, then people tend to cast off restraint. They go with instinct. They go with whatever feels right, whatever experience makes the most sense. We should heed wisdom and instruction, but then look what also he says in Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12. But there is a way that appears to be right. So you reject revelation and you cast off restraint because it seems to be right, seems to make sense, seems to feel good, matches my experience. But that way always leads to death. It will destroy you. It seems freeing to just be able to determine whatever you want and do whatever you want, but it's actually enslaving and it leads you to death, to destruction. Instinct is destructive. And here's the truth. And it's a hard truth, but it's a good truth. God's authority is there to keep us from our instincts because they're destructive. Don't cast off that revelation. Don't cast off the law and the authority that God has given us, because the reason he gave it to us is because the other option is understanding instinct leading to destruction. And so God's authority is there because our instincts are destructive. God's authority is there to keep us from our instincts, not to enslave us, not to prevent us from freedom. Jude's words echo Paul's description of warning to the Romans. Romans chapter 1, verse 22, he says, listen, people claim to be wise. I've got my own revelation. I've got my own wisdom. I'm a lawmaker and a judge in my own right because I know what's going on in life, and instead they become fools. Slaves to instinct leads to destruction. God's authority is there to keep us from our instincts because our instincts are destructive. And we may claim to be wise, but instead that's foolish, and the result shouldn't be surprising. Rejecting and rebelling against God's authority in favor of your own delusions is foolish, and it is a fatal mistake. So here's where this meets us today, this criticism that Jude gives of these people who rebel in immorality, and they rebel against God's authority because they delude themselves into thinking they're the lawmakers and judges, which isn't even something that the archangel was willing to do. But they're doing this, and instead of being free, they're slaves to instinct and leads to destruction. And so where does this meet us today? Because this isn't just for Jude's readers, this is for us. The fact that God has authority, even though it's there to keep us from our instincts, even though it's there to keep us from that destructive result that comes from our instincts, the fact that God has authority is challenging. It's challenging for us. The things that God reveals in his word as far as expectations and beliefs and how they translate into our lives, into our decisions, it's challenging because it's counterintuitive to our sin nature. It's often not going to feel right because of our instincts. They're corrupted by sin. And we struggle with the pride of life and the idea that we should be the captain of our own ships. And so his authority is challenging for us. And the truth is, in a very real way, every day for us, God's authority challenges our desires and our instincts, and that's hard. And each time it does, it puts us at a crossroads, and in that moment, we have a choice. We have a choice every day. We have a choice in every moment. We can replace God's authority based on the delusion of significance, claim that we're lawmakers and judges, or we can accept God's authority and avoid the rebellious mistake and the destructiveness of instinct. We have this choice. We can either replace God's authority or accept God's authority. And this isn't easy because there are times in God's Word and in the leading of the Holy Spirit that He asserts truth, He calls for obedience, and you won't understand it. It might not make sense to you. How could God be asking me to do this? Is this really a standard that God gives for us for life or the church or my family or for work? I don't understand how this will help, how following God here will help, or how this is possible, how this is a truth in the Bible. And you might not understand it, but even if you don't understand God's authority or what God has determined, you have a choice. I can take my confusion and say, since I don't understand this, I'm going to rewrite the law. I don't get this. I don't understand this. It doesn't make sense. I'm going to rewrite the law. I'm going to make my own truth here. I'm going to judge what God has said as not possible. It's not understandable. So I'm going to do something different. I'm going to determine my own way. I don't understand how this can be true, so I'm going to do it my way. And I'll give you an example here. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, God tells us that if we sacrifice willingly, and if we give willingly, if we are generous, He will enrich us so that we can be even more generous. If we give up what we need in generosity, God will give us more. We can be even more generous in that. And so if I sacrifice what little I have, if I let go of my hold on finances, God will actually provide more. And God says, no matter what, I'll take care of you. I'll give you what you need. I don't understand that. I don't understand that. I don't understand how that actually makes sense, that if I give up what little I have, He will actually provide more, because financially, that makes no sense. I don't understand it. I can't intuitively grasp how that is a logical conclusion. And I'm tempted to rewrite that and say, okay, I'll be generous when I can, but I'll take care of me first. And I'll only give what I have to. But that is rebellion in lawmaking and judgment, because I am delusional in thinking that I know better, that I can reason through it better. He must not have meant fully what that says. Because I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to me. But just because I might not understand why God's truth is that way, or why God says it works best this way, or why God asks for obedience in this way, it doesn't mean I can reject it. I have to accept it and say, that's for God to decide, and I surrender myself to His authority. I'm not the lawmaker and the judge here. It's not easy when we don't understand what God says. It also isn't easy because there are plenty of times in the expression of God's will through His Word and the Holy Spirit that He asserts truth or He calls for obedience that I just don't like. I just don't like it. I understand it. I don't like it. It goes against my feelings. It hurts my feelings. It makes life harder. It means I have to do something I don't want to, or change something I enjoy, or challenges something that I don't want to let go of. I don't like that God is telling me this is His standard for my life or my family or even the church. And if I submit to God's authority here, it might hurt. It might be uncomfortable. It won't be popular. It'll be challenging. But even if I don't like it, we still have a choice. We can take that dislike and balk at it and say, I don't like this. I'm going to rewrite the law and make my own truth here. I'm going to judge what God says, and it's not making me feel good. It's not doable, and I'm going to justify my own way. I'll give you an example. Matthew chapter 18, Jesus tells us that when someone sins against us and hurts us, that we're supposed to go to them and deal with that issue and then forgive them. And Peter says, I get that. I get it. But what if they keep doing it? Like, I get that I'm supposed to forgive them, but what if they keep doing it? How many times am I supposed to forgive them and let it go? Like, 7 times? And Jesus says, no, way more than that. Just keep forgiving. Peter's question, though, has to do with the feelings. At some point, I don't want to forgive. I want to get even. I don't feel like it. It doesn't feel right. It actually hurts being sinned against that many times, and just over and over again, I'm supposed to let them do it and just keep forgiving them. I want to withhold, though. I want them to hurt. Surely there's a point where I can respond based on how I'm feeling, and Jesus says, no, you have to forgive. Just because it doesn't match your feelings and just because you don't like it, you still have to do it. Not forgiving people actually feels good sometimes. But that's rebellion and lawmaking and judgment, because I'm delusional in that my feelings should be taken into account when it comes to truth and obedience. Just because I don't like it or it hurts or makes me change or be humbled or let go doesn't mean I can set aside God's authority and say, I'm the lawmaker here. I'm the judge here. I'll decide what actually works and fits. I have to accept it and say, this is for God to decide, and I surrender myself to Him, even if I don't like it. The other way, replacing God's authority, being your own lawmaker and judge, is just as destructive. It's purely destructive, and it's not based on wisdom. It's based on animal-like instinct. And so Jude wants us to recognize the delusion in thinking we can be lawmaker and judge. It causes rebellion, and it leads to slavery and devastation. And so as we pray here in a moment, I want you to consider, have I become my own lawmaker and judge because I don't understand or I don't like what God has determined? And if it's true, this is your opportunity to repent and tell God, I am sorry for taking your place. God, rebuke me. And then we're going to celebrate and we're going to sing that God is the one who was, is, and Father.